What has been seen cannot be unseen. Maybe this principle applies especially to those things that you'd rather not notice in the first place. Like the slightest imperfection in a paint job. Or a pimple on your chin. Or a dent in your car. Once you notice the problem, then the problem is all that you can see. What has been seen can't be unseen. You just as well not noticed it in the first place. Well, the resurrection story today is told in two different versions. And preachers all over the world are wrestling this morning with whether to tell the story according to Mark or whether to tell the story according to John. I'm just going to tell them both. So as Mark remembers the tale, it begins just after sunrise when three women, including Mary Magdalene and Mary the mother of James, go to visit the tomb of Jesus after he has been buried in order to anoint his body with oil and with spices. Along the way, they're having some conversation because they're worried that if the stone has been placed in front of the tomb, it may be too heavy for them to move. So they're somewhat relieved when they arrive at the tomb and the stone is already rolled away. They walk in and they're surprised to find that Jesus is not laying there as he's supposed to be laying there. And instead, in his place, there is a mysterious young man dressed entirely in a bright and glimmering white robe. And he tells them that Jesus has been raised from the dead, just as Jesus said that he would be raised from the dead, and that the women should go together immediately and tell everyone they know about this good news. Well, the women are confused and afraid, and instead of doing as the mysterious young man instructed them, they just run away, Mark says, in terror and amazement. The end. Thus concludes Mark's gospel. Abruptly, without so much as a single confirmed sighting of the risen Christ. It's a rather unsatisfying story of a resurrection, don't you think? And that's why somebody went back to Mark's gospel some years later and added a second ending to it. It's also why many preachers today won't be telling Mark's version of the story. They're going to tell John's version of the story. And it's true. John remembers it rather differently. In John's case, it's just Mary Magdalene. And the story begins before sunrise. She makes her way to the tomb. And she's surprised to find that the stone has been rolled away. Something is amiss, and she immediately suspects foul play. So Mary Magdalene runs off from the tomb to find Simon Peter and another disciple, and she tells them what she's found. They have taken away our Lord, and I don't know where they have laid him. Simon Peter and the other unnamed disciple then join her, and the three of them go together back to the tomb to investigate. Sure enough, as they enter the tomb, they find that Jesus' body is not where it is supposed to be. Instead, the linen wrappings that would have covered his body are strewn about across the ground of the tomb, carelessly. But the head covering that had gone over Jesus' head, it actually was rolled up very carefully. And it was tidily placed off to the side. It's almost as if Jesus got up in the morning and halfway made his bed. Well, Simon Peter and the other disciple, they don't know what to make of this, so they just go on back home. But Mary is lost in her grief. And she remains there by the tomb, sitting in the garden, weeping. And two angels appear to her, and they say, "Woman, why are you weeping?" And she says again, "They have taken away my Lord, and I don't know where they have laid him." Just then she turns around and she sees Jesus standing there, but she doesn't recognize him as Jesus. "Woman, why are you weeping?" he asks her. And she thinks that maybe he's the gardener. So she pleads with him, "Sir, if you have taken the body away, just tell me, where have you laid him?" And Jesus says her name, Mary. And this is the moment of recognition. Her eyes widen, her face brightens. "Rabboni," she says, and she embraces him. Well, the story is a little vague from there. We don't know exactly what happens next. One way or another, Jesus vanishes. But Mary, we know that she goes off from that encounter and embrace of Jesus. And she tells all of her friends, all of the friends and followers and disciples of Jesus, she says, "Truly, I have seen the Lord." So this is the difference between Mark's gospel and John's gospel, at least at this point in the resurrection story. The difference is that in John's gospel, Jesus actually appears in the flesh to Mary. Now, if you are vision impaired, I hope that you won't be discouraged by this story and all of the language about sight and seeing. Because I don't think it's just about sight and seeing. What John is trying to give us a sense of is Mary's lived experience of the risen Christ. Just think about all the details in the story. The environment, where she is in the garden. Her emotion. You can almost smell the flowers. How she hears him call her name, Mary. How she touches him, how she embraces him. And yes, as she sees him in the flesh, but it is a multi-sensory experience. And that's what makes her testimony so powerful later on. Because once you have experienced something, who has the authority to question your experience? Who can tell you that your experience is not valid? Nobody can. So it's not just about Mary's seeing of Jesus. It's about this whole encounter that she has with him and how it informs her experience later on. Once she sees him, she can't unsee him. The African-American novelist and literary critic James Baldwin tells a powerful story about how he once saw something in himself that he could not unsee. He writes in his memoir, Notes of a Native Son, about how he and a friend of his went out on the town one night in Trenton, New Jersey. They wanted to see a movie, but before they went to see the film, they dropped into this diner and they sat down at a table, and Baldwin told the server that they'd like to order a hamburger and a cup of coffee. She replied, "We don't serve Negroes here." Baldwin has been rejected before. He has lived his life under the long shadow of white supremacy. This is not an unfamiliar experience to him. He and his friend get up and leave, but this time the experience is different. And he can feel his heart burning within him as he reflects on the pain and the humiliation and the rejection and the fear that has accompanied his experience. He walks faster and faster down the sidewalk. His friend struggles to keep up with him. Finally, they arrive at another restaurant, and this is a really nice place. Lovely, pricey restaurant for white people in New Jersey. And he leads his friend inside, and they take a seat at one of the tables. And as they might have expected, a server promptly appears and says to them once again, "We don't serve Negroes here." Baldwin, he's becoming so angry. He wants to defend himself against the many disgraces that he has experienced. So he takes a mug, and when she says one more time the same thing, he hurls it at her, and it shatters against the window behind the bar. Well, Baldwin knows he's in trouble now, and his friend tells him to run. So Baldwin takes off running, but a white man grabs him by the nape of the neck and starts beating him. Still, he manages to break away. He vanishes into the night. His friend stays behind to misdirect his pursuers and the police who are arriving at the scene. Later that night, they regroup back together at his apartment. Baldwin survived. He says that he and his friend didn't have a lot to say to each other that night, but that he kept reliving the scene over and over again in his head in the most awful way. He said it was like surviving a car accident and how you might come back to that again and again. "I couldn't get over two facts," he writes. "Both equally difficult for the imagination to grasp, and one was that I could have been murdered. But the other was that I had been ready to commit murder." "It was true," he continues, "that my life, my real life, was in danger. And not from something anyone else might do to me, but from the hatred that I carried in my own heart." Whew. Baldwin's words took my breath away when I first read them. But he's writing about his lived experience, how he's seen something that he can't unsee within himself. And it hurts. His lived experience. I believe that Easter is a great mystery. And I don't know which account of the gospel we should take as history, but I think that the gospel is inviting us not to look outside of ourselves for visible evidences. I think it's actually inviting us to look inside of ourselves and backward across the landscape of our whole lives, to survey ourselves and to find the truth that can't be unseen. The gospel story means that Christ is present in the truth we can't unsee. I may wish for it to go away, but God's grace says that it will be okay. I may not want to look at it, but Jesus says that the truth is the only path to newness of life. And so when we see the truth, we have a choice to make, the gospel says to us. We can greet the truth as Mark greets the truth and run away in terror and amazement. Or we can greet the truth as John treats the truth. We can learn from Mary and embrace it. And when we see the truth, we can tell our friends, "Truly, I have seen the Lord."